Well, let's pray. Pray that you would bless our study now as we look at rhetoric, the subject that you've given us to understand you more and understand the world you've made. Father, thank you for your love for us. Please bless our time now in Christ's name. Amen. My name is Jim Nance. This is What is Rhetoric? If you're in the wrong place, now you know. I have taught at Logos School in Moscow, Idaho for the past 10 years. We teach a rhetoric class in both our junior and senior year at Logos. 4 years ago, we lost our former rhetoric teacher to, he went to teach at New St. Andrews, Chris Schleck. And Tom Spencer, our principal, was looking for a rhetoric teacher, and I said, well, you know, I'll step in and teach rhetoric until you can find a real rhetoric teacher. And I've now done it for the last 4 years and have absolutely fallen in love with the subject of rhetoric, and now they couldn't make me give it up. I teach the junior rhetoric class, the 11th grade rhetoric class. Other teachers teach 12th grade rhetoric. It was a difficult class for me. I am trained in mechanical engineering from Washington State University and mathematics, rather than history or literature or English, which would be far more applicable subjects. But Aristotle argues that rhetoric is not limited to professional rhetoricians, since all men attempt to persuade others. And so I will see what I can persuade you to think that I have something profitable to share here. One of the questions on the evaluation form on page 80 in your notebooks asks, what topics would you like to see covered in future conferences? On last year's conference in Austin, one person responded this way, I would like to see someone speak on how to teach rhetoric. I don't believe I've heard this covered. It seems to me to be a mystery. And I'd like to dispel some of that mystery here. I will talk first about what I mean by rhetoric. Secondly, how I teach it. Third, I'll go into some detail on what is taught in the class. And finally, I'll mention some resources available for teaching rhetoric. And then if we have some time, I'll look at an example. First, some classical definitions of rhetoric. In our day, rhetoric, the word itself, has been given a bit of a bad rap. When someone gives a speech that is empty of meaning but sounds grandiose, people say, that's just rhetoric. He's just giving rhetoric. Whenever the word is used in our public discourse, it has that negative connotation. Well, that has been the case for centuries. Socrates, even though he was himself skilled at rhetoric, attacks professional rhetoricians as those who, in their speaking, make the worst cause appear the better. That was Socrates. In Plato's dialogue called Gorgias, Socrates is arguing with Gorgias, a professional rhetorician, and Socrates argues that rhetoric is not an art at all, but merely the habit of a bold and ready wit which knows how to manage mankind. So that's the attacks on rhetoric. Well, Socrates, of course, was the teacher of Plato who wrote these things. Plato was the teacher of Aristotle. So Aristotle, to write a rhetoric textbook, as he did, had to be able to answer these critiques that were made against it. He argued that rhetoric is indeed an art which all men, even Socrates and Plato, had to use, though some, of course, use it more skillfully than others. Now, we can seek to determine why some speakers are better than others, and as we discover their methods, we develop the art of rhetoric. That's what Aristotle said. In chapter 2 of his textbook on rhetoric, Aristotle defines rhetoric as the faculty of observing, in any given case, the available means of persuasion. Now, he calls rhetoric a faculty. By faculty, he means a power or an ability. The Greek word there for faculty is dynamis, where we get dynamic and dynamite. It's a power or a faculty. And it's a faculty of observing the available means of persuasion. For Aristotle, the study of rhetoric is concerned not primarily with persuading, but with seeking to observe the means of persuasion, seeking to find the best ways to persuade. He argues that rhetoric, as a study, has more to do with what to say than how to say it. He concentrates on invention rather than on delivery, and we'll talk about what we mean by those two things here in a few minutes. Now, it's the faculty of observing in any given case, the available means of persuasion. Rhetoric is concerned not primarily with persuading about a particular subject, like politics or law, which is what Socrates was going after, but about any given subject. Rhetoric is a very comprehensive art. It covers all subjects. So Aristotle, in his text, says, every other art can instruct or persuade about its own particular subject matter. For instance, medicine about what is healthy or unhealthy, geometry about the properties of magnitude. But rhetoric we look upon as the power of observing the means of persuasion on almost any subject presented to us. The power of observing the means of persuasion on almost any subject. Now, in this speech, I'm going to refer to abortion, gun control, evolution, and many other topics. And rhetoric is concerned with all these topics and more because men deliberate on all these topics and more. And rhetoric seeks to persuade men on all these topics, on any given subject, anything that men deliberate about. Now, it is the art of persuasion. Persuasion is the moving of people to action or belief. And something is persuasive because there are people whom it persuades. Rhetoric is persuasive because it persuades someone. Thus, rhetoric is concerned with the audience, with the hearers of the speech. And this is one factor that distinguishes rhetoric from logic. Logic isn't so much concerned with the audience the way that rhetoric is. To successfully persuade, a rhetorician must know his audience. If I were speaking if I were arguing that abortion is murder, and trying to argue that way, I would choose different words when speaking before a Right to Life group than before speaking to a group from the National Organization of Women. Not because I would want to change what I say in terms of the substance of the speech, but because there'd be some things that were persuasive to the one group that wouldn't be as persuasive to the other. You have to know your audience, and that's something that I stress as a rhetoric teacher. So, according to Aristotle, rhetoric is the faculty of observing, in any given case, the available means of persuasion. Now, Quintilian's definition is a bit more broad than this. Quintilian was a Roman orator of the 1st century AD, so a few centuries after Aristotle. In book 2 of his volumes on rhetoric, and it's volumes on rhetoric, the Loeb, I think the Loebs have 3 or 4 different books that make up Quintilian's volumes. In book 2, Quintilian considers many definitions of rhetoric up to his day, about 20 different definitions that other people had given up to his day, and he ends up defining rhetoric as the science of speaking well. Quintilian argues first that a rhetorician must be a good man. A rhetorician must be a good man, otherwise we cannot say that he speaks well, the way he defined well. And speaking well, he says, is the goal of rhetoric. Now, this is important to emphasize with our students. The tools taught in rhetoric are powerful, and like any other powerful tool, they can be abused. Thus, in addition to rhetorical technique, we must teach virtue. We must require our students to speak whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, and all the other things that Paul says in Philippians 4:8. Christ said that out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. So we need to make sure that what's in the heart is right, so that right things are what overflow from it. Now, in terms of textbooks, at Logos, we have found that Aristotle's text is the most usable for teaching rhetoric to high school students. And Aristotle's Rhetoric is, in fact, our primary textbook in the junior year. One of our goals as classical educators is to guide students through original texts. I don't want my students to read what Horner or Corbett or Kennedy says that Aristotle says about rhetoric. I want them to read what Aristotle says about rhetoric. Aristotle is, in most cases, wonderfully clear. C.S. Lewis says in his essay on the reading of old books, "The great man, just because of his greatness, is much more intelligible than his modern commentator. It has always, therefore, been one of my main endeavors as a teacher to persuade the young that first-hand knowledge is not only more worth acquiring than second-hand knowledge, but is usually much easier and more delightful to acquire." And we found that to be the case with Aristotle's Rhetoric. Now, how do I teach Aristotle's Rhetoric to high school students? My method of teaching is threefold: theory, imitation, and practice. And you can have that first overhead. Theory, imitation, and practice. And that comes from another text called the Ad Herennium. Theory, he defines as, the author of the Ad Herennium defines as a set of rules which provide a definite system, or a definite method and system of speaking. For theory, we read and analyze Aristotle's text. For example, in his text, Aristotle, if he's talking about the theoretical elements of political oratory, We read what he says about political oratory, defined by him as any oratory which urges people to do or not to do something based on whether that action is expedient or harmful. And I give my students some assignment, some worksheet or other, asking them questions concerning what Aristotle says about political oratory. That's what I do for the theory. And then imitation is defined as that which stimulates us to attain the effectiveness of certain models of speaking. We look at good examples, good models of oratory in the example I'm giving of political oratory. For example, we might read Odysseus' speech before Achilles in Book 9 of the Iliad, where he's trying to urge Achilles to come back and fight and rescue, save the day. Or we read Henry V's St. Crispin's Day speech from Shakespeare. Or we might read a speech like Churchill's This Was Their Finest Hour. Any sort of speech where a person is trying to urge his audience to do or not to do something can be considered a political speech. Now, we read a great example of it. We read it. We analyze it. We try to determine, according to the theory, what is it that makes this such a great political speech. I may have them memorize it. I have my students memorize the St. Crispin's Day speech. And then they write a political speech in imitation of the style that they've looked at. That's the imitation. Theory, imitation, and practice. Practice is exercise and experience in speaking. Now, at this point, my students have seen what political oratory is. They've read and studied and memorized perhaps a great political speech. Now they must deliver their own political speech in front of the class. So they write a speech where they're urging someone to do or not to do something, and I don't care what the subject is. I let them choose. I've had students urge, one of the girls wrote a political speech urging girls not to wear high heels. It can be any subject whatsoever. It doesn't really matter as long as it's political, meaning urging someone to do or not to do something. And I grade that speech on their ethos, pathos, and logos. Their ethos, how they come across in their speaking, their pathos, how they relate to the audience, and their logos is their use of proofs. And that's our next overhead. Now, these three methods of persuasion correspond with the three elements of any speech situation. Ethos corresponds with the speaker, logos with the speech itself, and then pathos with the hearer. In the second chapter of his textbook, in the first book, second chapter, Aristotle identifies the three modes of persuasion, ethos, pathos, and logos, the ethical appeal, the emotional appeal, and then the logical appeal, or persuasion. Ethos is the speaker's personal character. Aristotle says this, "Persuasion is achieved by the speaker's personal character when the speech is so spoken as to make us think him credible. We believe good men more fully and readily than others," and so on. And he adds, this kind of persuasion, like the others, should be achieved by what the speaker says, not by what people think of his character before he begins to speak. It is true that what people think of a speaker before he speaks has a persuasive effect. It affects his ability to persuade. We do judge someone by their reputation. We judge them by their dress, by their demeanor. But all these things are outside the scope of rhetoric proper, and so that's not what Aristotle primarily is talking about. He's talking about the words we choose. The words we choose, especially at the beginning of a speech, will have a great effect on what our listeners think of our character. Now, I could have destroyed my ethos here in front of you all in a variety of ways. I could have come dressed in cutoffs and a t-shirt. I could come up here and apologize that I have a cold and I was up late and the metro broke down and I don't have much to say anyways. I could have acted condescending to you all. I could have abused you personally. I could have used bad grammar. I could have used profanity. All of that would have just turned you off to what I have to say. I could have destroyed my ethos easily, rather than seeking to establish good ethos, as I've tried to do. That's why I'm wearing a suit. Okay, now what are the necessary elements of establishing good ethos? Aristotle identifies three things which will inspire confidence in a speaker's own character, making his speech more credible or believable. Good sense, good moral character, and good will. Good sense. We believe someone more readily when they appear to know their subject, because we trust that they'll lead us into truth rather than into error. We believe someone who knows their subject. The more ignorant a speaker appears to be, the more readily we will dismiss what they have to say and not be persuaded by them. That only makes sense. But they might know their subject really well and have a bad moral character, and we wouldn't be as persuaded. good moral character is then the second thing that inspires confidence in the speaker's in what the speaker says. We more readily believe someone we consider to be a good man. Namely, what we might mean by a good man, someone who portrays the same set of moral values as ourselves, because we believe that they'll lead us into thinking what we already believe to be good. Now, in our understanding as Christians, we believe a Christian more readily than a non-Christian, because we believe that they'll lead us into the same set of moral values that that we believe we should have. We feel that their results will line up with the values that we will want to see implemented, and so we'll be more readily persuaded. Someone might have good sense. We might believe them to be a good person. But if we think that they're out for their own interest and out to pull the wool over our eyes, we won't be persuaded. The third element is goodwill. We more readily believe someone who has our best interests in mind, while we tend to disbelieve those that we distrust. Used car salesmen have the reputation of destroying their ethos at this point. We may believe that they know everything about those cars, and that they live perhaps personally moral, upright lives. But if we suspect that they're trying to fool us and trying to make us buy something that we shouldn't buy, then we distrust their character and we find ourselves not wanting to be persuaded by them. So, ethos has those three elements: good sense, good moral character, and goodwill. You have to do those three things to have good ethos, and losing any one of them will destroy your ethos. Now, the second mode of persuasion, the one on the far end, is pathos. Pathos, the proper stirring of the hearer's emotions. The rhetorician must understand what causes different emotions in the audience, and he should know how to excite those emotions. Now, note that pathos is the proper stirring of emotions. Aristotle, in saying this, was not advocating the manipulation of emotions. He, in fact, has harsh things to say about those who misuse rhetoric this way. He says, "The arousing of prejudice, pity, anger, and similar emotions has nothing to do with the essential facts. It is not right to pervert the judge," and by that he means any of the hearers, anybody who's being persuaded, "it is not right to pervert the judge by moving him to anger or pity. One might as well warp a carpenter's rule before using it." Now that's Aristotle, who gives us perhaps the most detailed philosophy of emotions that we have from the ancient world. But he understands their proper place. Now, which emotions are proper to excite depends upon the speaker's goal for the speech. Is he Henry V or William Wallace seeking to inspire his troops before the battle? Then it's right and proper to stir up the emotions of confidence and emulation in other great warriors. Or is he Martin Luther defending his writings at the Diet of Worms? Then it's proper and wise to seek to calm their anger toward him while speaking the truth. The point is that we are men, not computers. We're men, not Vulcans. Okay? God has made us with both intellect and emotion. He's made us to communicate with each other and to be persuaded by each other on both levels. And we must be careful not to deceive men through our intellects, nor deceive them through our emotions. Emotions have a proper place, but they do have a proper place. Okay? Now, Aristotle develops his philosophy of emotions in some detail in Book 2 of his rhetoric text. My students do a worksheet answering these questions about, you know, they work through all the emotions and answer three different questions about each emotion that Aristotle spells out. That's the theory. And then they read or hear speeches designed to produce different emotions. We read through Martin Luther's speech, "Here I Stand." Martin Luther does almost everything that Aristotle says you need to do to calm an audience who might be angry toward you. We read Jonathan Edwards, "Sinners in the Hand of an Angry God." Edwards is obviously trying to produce fear. I am absolutely persuaded that Edwards had Aristotle's text in front of him, because he does everything that Aristotle says you should do to produce fear in the audience. And we read through quite a few different emotional speeches. And the students seek to imitate that in their own writing. And then they write and deliver a speech designed to produce a particular emotion. It's very difficult for students to do, because the emotion that is almost, they almost always end up producing is laughter, humor in the audience, because they all know what they're up there trying to do. But I have some students who do it really well, who can take advantage of that situation, knowing where their audience is, and turn around and produce proper emotions, and it's a delight to see it actually happen. Aristotle's third mode of persuasion is logos, proving a truth by means of persuasive arguments. Now, to use this mode of persuasion, a speaker must know how to reason logically. Thus, in my class, we spend a good deal of time reviewing the essential elements of logic that the students have learned earlier in their eighth grade year. Aristotle argues that there are two methods of proof, enthymeme and example. He says, everyone who affects persuasion through proof does in fact use either enthymeme or example. There is no other way of proving. Aristotle defines an enthymeme as a rhetorical syllogism, consisting of fewer propositions than a formal syllogism. Someone is using an enthymeme whenever they make a claim and then support it with reasons. To hear an enthymeme, listen for the words because or since or for. When you run across those words, you're probably hearing an enthymeme. Someone's making a claim and then supporting it with reasons. That's what Aristotle means. I teach my students how to recognize enthymemes and how to determine what's being left assumed in an enthymeme. It's a very important tool to know what the speaker is assuming. For example, this sentence I am now speaking is an enthymeme because in it I am making a claim and supporting it with reasons. Okay? You catch that? Now, listen to this enthymeme and see if you can figure out what assumption is being made. What universal assumption is being made in this enthymeme? Since handguns may be misused to hurt innocent people, handguns should be outlawed. Since handguns may be misused to hurt innocent people, handguns should be outlawed. Now, the universal claim is anything which may be used to misused to hurt innocent people must be outlawed, right? Okay. Now, then we can ask ourselves, now that we understand what they're assuming, even though they don't say it, then we can say, is that true? Anything that can be misused to hurt innocent people should be outlawed? What about rhetoric? What about knives? Perhaps look for counterexamples like that. Now, Aristotle defines example as basing the proof of a proposition on a number of similar cases. If I wanted to prove that handguns can be misused to hurt innocent people, I could bring to mind any number of recent school shootings. I might bring statistics, which is another kind of example. And analogies, also, are another kind of example. Now, Aristotle's analogy, comparing the misuse of emotion to the warping of a carpenter's rule, was a kind of argument by example. Analogies are wonderful tools in rhetoric. Doug Wilson is the master of the analogy or the metaphor. If your school is the government school is 10 years ago, you're 10 yards further down the avalanche. You know, we all understand what he means by that. We know how analogy works, and it's a delight when someone can use it well. Okay, so those are the three modes of persuasion that we teach: ethos, pathos, and logos. I want to look at the five canons of rhetoric, the faculties that the speaker should possess. Now, these were spelled out for us in the Ad Herennium, which is a rhetoric text written by some unknown author of the first century A.D. For years, they thought it was Cicero who wrote it, and have since concluded that it wasn't. The five canons of rhetoric: invention, arrangement, style, memory, and delivery. Now, these are arranged not according to importance, but according to chronology, when we actually run up against them in the development or the writing and giving of any speech. Invention is developing what you are going to say, or as the author of the Ad Herennium puts it, the devising of matter, true or plausible, that would make the case convincing. Now, this matter has consisted of two parts, common topics and special topics. Common topics are forms of arguments that can be used for any given subject. Aristotle calls them universal or general lines of argument. In his second book, he identifies 28 lines of argument which could be considered by a speaker who's in the stage of invention, trying to come up with what to say in his speech. Topics such as arguing by definition, arguing by opposites, by dilemma, by induction, by logical division, and so on. He gives 28 different ones. Arguing by a person's name, and so on. It's interesting to read. Now, what we've said about enthymeme, an example, also falls under common topics. They can be applied to any given subject, any kind of speech. The best way to get familiar with common topics is the study of logic proper. It's at this point that logic connects to rhetoric in the study of topics with invention. A good source of some common topics outside of Aristotle for the modern reader who's unfamiliar with logic is Anthony Weston's A Rule Book for Arguments. It's published by Hackett Publishing Company. Canon Press has about a dozen available for sale on their textbook, on their book display. Special topics, or special lines of argument, are arguments which apply to some topics and not to others. Aristotle concentrates on special lines of argument in Book 1, where he details three different types of speeches. He says, in any speech situation, there's one of three different types of speeches: political, ceremonial, or forensic. Now, political speeches, as I mentioned briefly already, those in which the hearer is urged to do or not to do something based on whether that thing is expedient or harmful. Its goal is therefore persuasion or dissuasion. Ceremonial speeches are speeches of praise or censure. You're praising someone or you're censuring them. And forensic or judicial speeches are speeches of accusation and defense, what you find in the courtroom. Special topics are lines of arguments which apply to one of these specifically. So Aristotle develops different lines of arguments that you'd use in a political speech, and then lines of argument that you'd use in a ceremonial, and then in a forensic speech, and spells them out specifically. So that's the first canon is invention. The second canon of rhetoric is arrangement, which is the ordering and distribution of matter which has been invented. If invention is what you say, arrangement is when you say it. Now, the Ad Herennium identifies the six standard parts of a speech: introduction, statement of fact, division, proof, refutation, and conclusion. Now, that's been outlined differently by different authors. Aristotle doesn't outline it this way, and other later rhetoricians don't either. But this is what we use with from the Ad Herennium. And it was designed primarily for forensic speeches in the courtroom, but it can be modified to be used in any given speech. The introduction, also called the exordium, is the beginning of a discourse by which the hearer is made receptive, well-disposed to us, and attentive. An abrupt entry into the main body of speech is rarely appropriate. Usually it's best to ease the hearers into the subject in some way. Now, the discussion on introduction in the Ad Herennium is especially helpful. If you want to know how to do an introduction, look at the Ad Herennium. It's available in the Loeb Classic Library. For example, here's what the Ad Herennium suggests for conference attendees. If the hearers have been fatigued by listening, we shall open with something that may provoke laughter. And then he lists 17 things which do so. Or we shall promise to speak otherwise than we have prepared. Yeah, I was going to say this, but I'm actually going to say this other thing. If they've been fatigued, you might hear, you know, see someone saying that. There's a movie called A Time to Kill. If you ever saw A Time to Kill, it's this lawyer, and he comes up and knowing that they've gone through this long, long trial, he comes up and says, you know, I had this great closing argument written for you, full of a lot of good lawyering, but I'm not going to give it at all. Instead, I'm going to tell you a story. It was just what he needed to do at that particular instance. Okay. Or we will promise that we'll not talk as others usually do. Most men would say this at this time, but I'm going to say this. If they're fatigued, then you say it like that, and it might wake people up a bit. Okay. Now, any good modern rhetoric test will give a number of suggestions for different types of introductions. Another excellent modern rhetoric text for introductions is Edward Corbett's Classical Rhetoric for the Modern Student. He has a great discussion on introduction. Classical Rhetoric for the Modern Student by Corbett. Okay, statement of facts, also called narratio. This is the setting forth of the events that have occurred or might have occurred, what might be called the background. This has been divided differently by other rhetoricians. Here the speaker provides the necessary historical details, and here is where he defines key words. The Ad Herennium explains how to make the narratio, or the division, brief, clear, and plausible. Division falls into two parts. He says we ought first to make clear what matters are agreed upon and what matters are contested by our opponents. Okay, so where I agree with my opponent and then where I disagree. For example, if I was giving a speech against gun control, my division might sound something like this. I agree that our streets, our stores, and our schools are becoming more dangerous every day, and that this danger is made real when people, especially young people, bring guns into public places with the intent to kill. But I do not believe that legislation which takes guns out of the hands of law-abiding citizens should constitute the first line of defense. Now, that sounds like something out of a gun control speech. And that person's doing his divisio right there, his division. He's saying, here's where I and my opponents agree, but here's where I disagree, and this is what I'm going to concentrate on in my speech. At that point, the speaker then presents his thesis. Now, I'm going to argue this way instead. And then he announces the point that he intends to prove. So he enumerates his points. The auditorium says, number your points, give anywhere between 3 and 7. If you argue less than 3 points, it looks like you don't have enough to say. If you argue more than 7, they're going to forget what you said. Somewhere between 3 and 7. Interesting fact of our personalities there. And then you summarize your proofs. I'm going to argue 3 proofs, and they are these. Ba-dunk, ba-dunk, ba-dunk. And then you get into your proof. The proof, also called the confirmatio, this is the presentation of our arguments as outlined in the division, together with their corroboration. Proofs can be arranged according to strength. The two strongest arguments, if you have a number of arguments, the two strongest should be placed first and last, with your weaker arguments in the middle, going from weakest to strongest. So strongest or second strongest argument first, and then weaker, weaker, stronger, 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 and then the first or second strongest last. Okay? If you start off with your weakest arguments, the audience might scoff and not listen to the remainder. If you start off with your strongest arguments and go to your weakest, then you leave the weakest in their memories when they leave. So start and end with your strongest and sandwich the weaker ones in the middle. Proofs can be arranged in some other obvious way. Arguments might appear chronologically, for example. Or if your arguments are of equal strength and no other obvious arrangement presents itself, then give those arguments first, which would first occur in the minds of the hearers. If your fifth proof is one that they've been anticipating all along, they won't hear your first four. So if you know that they're anticipating one, go ahead and put that up near the beginning as well. Okay. So I teach my students all about this sort of thing. Then refutation, called the confutatio or refutatio, the destruction of our opponent's arguments. This section is often combined with proof or placed before proof, depending on the purpose of your speech. Refutation can also be arranged according to strength, but here, because you're attacking your opponent's arguments, start with his strongest arguments and end by attacking his weakest. Because that makes it appear that you're willing to meet his strongest arguments head on, but it also leaves his weakest arguments lingering in the minds of the hearers. Two things that you want to get done. Now, there are many different methods of refutation. I want to mention three here real briefly. Refutation by reason, refutation by ethical appeal, refutation by wit. Refutation by reason is where you attack their logic. You either show their premises are false or flawed in some way, or show where their logic is flawed, where what they say is somehow invalid. Refutation by ethical appeal is where you defend your own character. Aristotle says it's more fitting for a good man to display himself an honest fellow than a subtle reasoner. We trust an honest fellow more than we do a subtle reasoner. If you ever notice, all of Shakespeare's bad guys are subtle reasoners, and not for no reason. A refutation by wit. Humor will often make your audience more favorably disposed to you. Gorgias, a great ancient rhetorician, said this, "Kill your opponent's seriousness with ridicule, and his ridicule with seriousness." And I think he has some good insight there. Now, note how Jesus refutes his opponents. Jesus uses all three of these methods of refutation. He refutes them by reason. Jesus is the master of the dilemma and the counter-dilemma. By reason. Or they say, should we pay taxes to Caesar or not? And he says, coming back with, give to Caesar what is Caesar, and to God's what is God's. Great example of refutation by reason with this counter-dilemma. Refutation by ethical appeal. Jesus uses this when he says, can any of you prove me guilty of sin? If I am telling the truth, then why don't you believe me? Okay? He appeals to his own personal character and refutes them. Or refutation by wit. They come to him and say, teacher, rebuke your disciples. And he says, if I tell you, if they keep quiet, the stones will cry out. Refutation by wit. Or when they're about to stone him, and he says, I've shown you many great miracles from the Father. For which of these do you stone me? I love it. I bet the audience just roared with laughter when he said that. And we're so used to it, because we've read it since we were children. But that's funny. It's funny, trust me. Okay, then the conclusion, the conclusio, called other things by other authors. Now, without a conclusion, a speech stops, but it doesn't end. We want our speeches to end. Aristotle mentions 4 things a conclusion can do. It can inspire the audience with a favorable opinion of ourselves and an unfavorable opinion of our adversaries. It can amplify strong points made earlier. We can use it to rouse appropriate emotions and rouse our audience to action. Or we can recapitulate and summarize our major points. And that's perhaps the most common kind of conclusion. Okay, so much for arrangement. I teach arrangement primarily from the Ad Herennium rather than from Aristotle. Style, mention arrangement style, the third canon. Style is the adaptation of suitable words and sentences to the matter devised. Your arguments have been invented. You've come up with them. You've arranged them in a particular way. Now they have to be made to sound good. If invention is the what and arrangement is the when, style is the how of a speech. Style, to be good, must be clear, appropriate, and natural. A speech is clear when the words chosen are familiar with the audience, and so you have to know what your audience understands. You choose different words speaking to second graders than you do to seniors in college. It has to be clear. The style has to be appropriate. It's appropriate when it adds to rather than detracts from a speech. Now, making a speech sound natural, the third element, is perhaps the most difficult part of style for our students, especially when they're trying to remember all the rules. Slow down. Speak up. Don't pace. Don't say Have good eye contact. Don't lose your place. All these other things we throw at our students. It's like learning to ski. Keep your back straight, your knees bent. Face forward, wait on the uphill ski, and all these things, and you're just trying to ski. Okay? Well, speaking, it's the same way. The students say, how can I keep all these things in mind when I'm just trying to speak? And it takes practice, like anything else. It takes practice to be natural. But speakers who present themselves as natural are indeed the most persuasive. Now, style is also concerned with embellishment, with figures of speech and figures of thought. Figures of speech are artistic variations from the ordinary arrangement of words. Figures of speech, artistic variation from the ordinary arrangement of words. Figures of speech like parallelism. You run into parallelism in lines like, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. I mean, that's a wonderful, wonderfully crafted sentence. Even the rhythm of it, our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. Doesn't it just sound nice? He knew what sounded good to our ears. Figures of speech like antithesis. That's one small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind. This antithesis, the opposite thing. There's other good figures of speech. Alliteration. As one man more methinks would share from me for the best hope I have. One man more methinks. All those M's just sound good when they all run together. There's others, asyndeton and polysyndeton, whether you put ands in between words or not, and so on. Lots of different figures of speech. Figures of thought are artistic variations of words from their normal meaning rather than from their normal arrangement. Figures of thought, like metaphor and simile, personification, synecdoche and hyperbole, and all these other things that they learn about in their English class. Now, it's at this point that students should be making conscious and regular use of the figures of speech and thought which they no doubt have been introduced to in previous classes, probably all the way back into their grammar years. Any good modern rhetoric textbook will identify lots of figures of speech and thought with lots of examples, and so I won't go into a lot of them here. But I teach my students that it is art to conceal art. It is art to conceal art. Longinus, who was a first century Greek critic, wrote this, a figure is at its best, and by figure he means a figure of speech or thought, a figure is at its best when the very fact that it is a figure escapes attention. Now, when Doug Wilson gave the thing I'll go back to the other one. The school that's 10 years ahead of the government schools is 10 yards further up the avalanche, or whatever he said. Anyways, so when he said it, you didn't notice. You didn't say, "Oh, what a great metaphor!" Like I did when I was sitting there. Oh, maybe you did. As a rhetoric teacher, I get distracted when people use metaphors because I hear them and I think, "Oh, I got to write that one down and analyze it and all this other stuff." Oh well. Okay, but someone uses it well when they can conceal it. Now, we also teach, in terms of style, that there are three levels of style, grand, middle, and simple. The grand level is exalted, ornate, or impressive use of words. Here, figures of speech and thought are made very obvious. The use of this level carries the hearers to joy. The grand level is appropriate for formal occasions. It's more appropriate for plenary speeches than for workshops, for example. The simple level is where we're brought down to ordinary language. Figures of speech are concealed here, although they're still used. This speech is obviously more simple, and the middle level is obviously between the two. Now, pay attention to the plenary speakers, and I think of the three plenary speakers we have, one of them exemplifies the grand style, one the middle, and one the simple. And I think you'll be able to figure out which one's which pretty easily, and I think you probably already know, some of you, especially if you've heard these three speakers before. The fourth faculty a speaker must possess is a good memory, which is the firm retention in the mind of the matter, words, and arrangement. I think it was Charles Spurgeon who says, "The best read speech tastes of paper." And that's true. The more we can memorize, the better a speech comes across. In the grammar stage, students practice memorizing quite a bit, and they're given tools by which they memorize. We employ those tools at this level also. The tools learned in the grammar years aren't forgotten from the grammar years. We use them all the way up. The classical authors of rhetoric give a few suggestions for how to memorize, usually employing some method of mnemonics or some method of word association, but they don't give a whole lot. But one thing they said that I thought was especially important that I try to carry across to my students is that well-crafted sentences are more easily memorized. Well-crafted sentences, sentences that roll off our tongue, we memorize more easily. Finally, delivery. Delivery, the graceful regulation of voice, countenance, and gesture. Cicero said, "Delivery is the dominant power in oratory." Demosthenes called delivery of first importance. Obviously, a speaker who fails in his delivery, even if he's skilled in the other four faculties, will fail to achieve his purpose. In terms of gesture, I simply teach my students that less is best. Make your gestures natural by trying not to make any. Make no gestures, especially, which will distract your audience. For countenance, I primarily work on eye contact with my students and a countenance which is appropriate to the speech, how your face looks. In terms of voice, we practice three main aspects: projection, speed, and tone. Projection, obviously, the speaker should be audible. The audience will overlook almost everything else, but they'll never forgive you if they can't hear you. And it's just so true. Volume should be varied appropriately. Speak softly and slowly when you're trying to gain attention. Okay? And speak loudly and regularly when making an important point. Vary your volume. Speed, the most common failure here, this is my own failure, is speaking too quickly. Okay? The speaker should vary his speed. The speaker should make good use of pause to gain attention to important points and also to give the hearers a rest. Practicing what I preach. Tone. Here, the most common failure is the monotone. The speaker must be expressive to avoid boring his audience. He has to vary his tone. His emotion should be appropriate to the subject. If he's speaking about mathematics, he should be passionate, for example. Okay. These are skills my students practice and are judged on with every speech they give. I expect more from them as the year goes on. And the final assessment of all these skills, invention, arrangement, style, memory, delivery, the final assessment is the thesis paper, which they write and present and defend at the end of the year, at the end of their junior year. And that's their practice thesis, because they give their real thesis papers and defenses in their senior year, where they actually have a faculty committee come in and judge them. My students in the junior year only have to defend their thesis in front of me, and I'm not too intimidating, and in front of their fellow students. I don't think I'm too intimidating, at least. Now, I trust that I helped you see something of what rhetoric is, how it can be taught, and what the skills are that we concentrate on teaching. In terms of resources, the student texts that we use two main texts, The Rhetoric and Poetics of Aristotle, translated by W. Rhys Roberts. McGraw-Hill is the publisher. I went around to every book table asking if someone was selling Aristotle's Rhetoric, and nobody is out there. They have his Poetics, but they don't have his Rhetoric. It really surprised me. Canon Press used to sell it and doesn't anymore. But The Rhetoric and Poetics of Aristotle is what we use. It's the same translation that's in the Great Book series, if you happen to have that. The Ad Herennium, we use the Loeb Classical Library version of the Ad Herennium. It's a single volume, and it's excellent. The translation that we use is by H. Kaplan. And those are our two primary textbooks. We work through Aristotle's Rhetoric. We work all the way through that during the course of the year. Actually only through books one and two. Book 3, where he gets into more into style and delivery, we don't get into that all that much. And we use the Ad Herennium at different places throughout the year where the Ad Herennium is strongest, like in terms of arrangement. Some additional books, Quintilian's books, his volumes on rhetoric are essential and they're outstanding. We use, again, the Loeb Classical Library one, and the students don't get the Quintilian's text. They do get the rhetoric and the Ad Herennium, but I use the Quintilian myself and just use it at different times throughout the year. An excellent history of rhetoric is A New History of Classical Rhetoric by George Kennedy, Princeton University Press. Kennedy's translation of Aristotle for Rhetoric is also excellent. And then I use Rhetoric in the Classical Tradition by Winifred Horner by St. Martin's Press. It's a very good textbook to use. Most of her examples are feministic, but she does have a lot of excellent speeches as well that I bring into my classroom. Okay. Go ahead and put that last... I have a overhead here. You guys probably can't read that, can you? Except the people in front, alas. This is a section of an essay called Evolution as Fact and Theory by Stephen Jay Gould. Now, I use this, in fact, on a test for my students. I have them find his introduction, his statement of facts, and his division. Those are the three sections here, and it's not too hard because it's the three paragraphs. And here I have them analyze it for ethos, pathos, and logos. And let me read through it and tell you what he does in terms of ethos, pathos, and logos. He says this. Now, he's trying to prove that evolution isn't what creationists say it is. That's his. So it's, to a certain extent, his purpose is a refutation. His opening sentence is powerful to persuade. Curtly Mather, who died last year at age 89, was a pillar of both science and the Christian religion in America and one of my dearest friends. Boom. Right away he comes out hard. Okay, with ethos. He establishes his ethos by saying, I have a friend who's a Christian, and so I'm fair here. I'm not out to attack Christians. Okay, and I'm not personally opposed to Christians. And there's Christians who argue on my side of the issue, and I'm informed on both sides. With that opening sentence, he does all that and bringing in a little emotion because he's talking about a good friend of his who just died. Okay? Excellent use of ethos and pathos. He says, the difference in half a century in our age is evaporated before our common interests. The most curious thing we shared was a battle we each fought at the same age. For Curtly had gone to Tennessee with Clarence Darrow to testify for evolution at the Scopes trial of 1925. When I think that we are enmeshed again in the same struggle for one of the best documented, most compelling and exciting concepts in all of science, by that he means evolution, I don't know whether to laugh or cry. Now there's logos and pathos. He says evolution is one of the perhaps the best documented and most compelling concept. Compelling, documented, there's an argument, a hidden argument. For pathos, he says evolution is exciting and compelling. And then he doesn't say it outright, but he implies then that creationism is either ridiculous or it's saddening. I don't know whether to laugh or cry, meaning it's either ridiculous or saddening. Okay? So he's making his audience feel something here. And that's his intro. For his statement of facts, he says this. According to idealized principles of scientific discourse, the arousal of dormant issues should reflect fresh data that give renewed life to abandoned notions. Those outside the current debate may therefore be excused for suspecting that creationists have come up with something new or that evolutionists have generated some serious internal trouble. But nothing has changed. The creationists have not a single new fact or argument. Darrow and Bryan were at least more entertaining than the lesser antagonists today. The rise of creationism is politics, pure and simple. It represents one issue and by no means the major concern of the resurgent evangelical right. Arguments that seemed kooky just a decade ago have re-entered the mainstream. Okay? Logos. Creationists have no new arguments. They're just rehashing old ones that were more entertaining when they gave them the first time. Ethos. I'm familiar with the debate, he says. There should be fresh data here, and there's not. I know how to do this, he says. Pathos. Creationism is pure politics. It's kooky. It's foolish. He's trying to establish contempt in his hearers or his readers, right? Okay, that's his statement of facts. In terms of division, where he's going to go. He says the basic attack of creationists falls apart on two general counts. There's his enumeration. Before we even reach the supposed factual details of their complaints against evolution, that tells you where he's going to go. First, they play upon a vernacular misunderstanding of the word theory to convey the false impression that we evolutionists are covering up the rotten core of our edifice. Second, they misuse a popular philosophy of science to argue that they're behaving scientifically in attacking evolution. Yet the same philosophy demonstrates that their own belief is not science, and that scientific creationism is therefore meaningless and self-contradictory, a superb example of what Orwell calls newspeak. And then he starts getting into his proofs. Now I dare say that this is persuasive. And he's doing everything he's supposed to do in terms of ethos, pathos, and logos, in terms of the arrangement of his essay. And so it's just one good example, and we look at a lot of examples. This was just, the reason I use this isn't because I agree with Gould. I don't. I think his essay itself has a lot of problems. But simply because it's short and fit on one overhead. So, and because he did a reasonably good job. Okay. I think I'm done. Thank you. Are there any questions from the floor that you think a lot of people might have? Yes, sir.
You mentioned that most of us have a junior year. What do you mean senior?
Practice, practice, practice. The senior year, they concentrate more on style and delivery. I concentrate on invention, arrangement, and memory. They work primarily on their two thesis papers. The first thesis paper is a persuasive paper. The second one is argumentative. The first one, the audience is assumed to be a friendly audience, and so they're just trying to persuade. The second one, the audience, and that means us teachers, is assumed to be a combative audience, and we try to find any small error and exploit it. And so we just try to make them as nervous as possible, preparing them for that the big bad world out there. Okay? It's a delight. Yes, sir?
Do you think that the art of sound bites?
The art of sound bites?
Yeah. I mean, do you think that the art of sound bites
I don't talk about it very much. I know that Wes Callahan does in his online class on rhetoric, because he gets into Neil Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death, and Postman talks a lot about that. So if you want to learn about the rhetoric of soundbites, look at Neil Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death. But no, that's not one thing I get into very much in the class, formally at least. I probably do informally. Because I do spend time talking about developing your proofs in detail rather than just the soundbite mentality. But soundbites have their place, no doubt, too. Other questions?